Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money audio commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 11:28. That is Pacific Summer Time, and today is October 7th. And of course, today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. And I am also recording a concurrent video, and you'll be able to find a link to this video on the comment of the day once I've posted it. Well, when we look at this week, there is really a lot to talk about, and perhaps the two markets that have really had the most psychological impact are the pound and gold. Gold pulled back very sharply early this week and has so far not rallied. It is currently trading in the region of the 200-day moving average, but in order for the medium-term bullish hypothesis to continue to be credible, then it really does need to find support soon, and then stage an impressive rally similar to what we saw back in June. Now, if we kind of look at this over the last 10 years, then we saw an important peak posted in 2011 that followed an acceleration which had developed following what had been a really quite a consistent advance between about late 2009 and all the way through into late 2000 or early 2011. That transitioned into a much more volatile environment, and then we had a really clear breakdown from a fairly well-defined range in early 2013, and prices trended lower for about 3 years. Now, we saw an impressive rally which broke a medium-term progression of lower rally highs at the beginning of this year. And so far, well, having seen that, we could conclude that the medium-term downtrend had been broken. Now, the big question is whether this medium-term advance is going to persist. And in order for it to remain reasonably consistent and therefore easier to participate in for investors, then it will need to find support reasonably soon. And it really is for the bulls to prove at this particular stage, because of the sharpness of the decline, which will have unsettled just about everyone who has a long position. And that is something that and certainly the bears and those with short positions have certainly had their hopes and aspirations. They have definitely had everything that they wished for this week. So what happens next week is really going to tell us a lot about where we are. Now, when we look at the pound, then this today was a flash crash, and that is not just a small term that we use. Could it have been larger, and have we seen larger flash crashes in other markets? Yes, we have, and I don't think it matters whether one is particularly got a position in the pound or not. Today's move was a very large one overall, and it is worth considering that this is a currency. This is a very, very large liquid market, and it was extraordinarily influenced by algorithmic trading systems in here today, where that decline to 118 happened in a matter of minutes. And then we saw an equally impressive rebound. Now, there are a number of things that we can conclude. One is that this was a computer-driven decline. The second is that it does nothing to bolster sentiment. And we've seen this time and again, that when you get these flash crashes, it really gets people to start asking important questions. And the first and perhaps most important is, if something like this can happen to the pound, or gold can pull back so violently on really very little news, then can the same thing happen in other markets? And of course, the answer is yes. The answer is that yes, it can happen in other markets. So that is at least a partial reason to be a bit more cautious about other markets. And we have seen a bit of that in here today. What we've seen today has been that the yen, which has been rallying, sorry, which had been falling, rallied in here today. And if we look at that that trend that we see in the appreciation of the yen since early this year, then 104 represented the progression of lower rally highs, and it has not pushed through the 104 level today. When we look at the trend overall, then there is still an oversold condition relative to the trend mean, and really you would need to see a sustained move above that for the dollar to really indicate that the dollar has returned to a position of demand dominance beyond short-term steadying. When we look at other markets, then there was an initial sell-off on Wall Street, but it has recouped some of that decline. The majority of indices in Europe were in negative territory, but of course the weakness of the pound contributed to a nominal advance in the FTSE 100. And actually right now the Dow Jones is trading in very, very mildly positive territory. There are substantial challenges facing the market, and the other market that has been falling all week and was a little bit firmer in here today was the Treasury market. We've had a substantial move in yields this week, and now we're right back in the region of the trend mean, and you can see quite clearly that that was a new all-time low in July, that it's a failed downside break, and now it is testing the region of the trend mean, and it hasn't sustained a move above the trend mean in a fair amount of time. And a sustained move above the 1.8% level would really be required to signal that supply dominance is back in the driver's seat in the Treasury markets. So we are at a rather interesting point overall for a significant number of markets, because despite the fact that we have had big moves in currencies and we've had some big moves in the precious metal markets, the stock market has been really inert. If we look at this chart just over the last month, then particularly over the last week, it has been up one day, down the next, and there is a fairly it seems to be a reliable rhythm in there today. Now, this has been really very inert overall. If we just simply contrast the trading that we've seen since July with the trading that we saw between April and July, then this has been considerably less volatile, much more inert. But we also know that these very inert periods of time give way to much more volatile periods. It is, I think, worth just keeping in mind all the time that this has been a particularly volatile period between early 2015 and the middle of this year, that the market has broken upwards, that the last downward dynamic was downwards, but that it continues to hold the 2100 area. It's continuing to trade above the 200-day moving average, and as long as it's doing that, no one will have experienced profit erosion. Certainly, people will have experienced profit erosion in the currency markets, in the bond markets, and in the commodity markets, particularly the precious metal markets this week, but not so much in the broad equity markets. And the relative strength of companies like Amazon or like Google or Facebook or Microsoft, which are extraordinarily large weightings in these indices, well, they're helping to support the overall market. When we take a sort of a step back now and look at some of the bigger picture, then I think the dollar is something that I think is going to be playing an increasingly important role overall, because the dollar was pretty firm in here today, and it hasn't quite broken that progression of lower rally highs that's in evidence there in this what is a triangular kind of wedgy pattern overall, that for at least the last year. So that the dollar was a little bit softer in here today, at least against the euro. And what it really does need to do is to break out of this sort of wedgy pattern overall. There is a progression of lower rally highs, there's a progression of higher reaction lows. Generally speaking, when we see that, it's an indication that when the breakout comes, it is going to be emphatic. And 100 represents an area of potential resistance. It has been an area of resistance for the last year and a half already, and a sustained move above that would reaffirm dollar dominance. It could act as a potential bullish catalyst overall for Europe and Japan, but it would potentially act as a headwind for Wall Street. And it would probably be associated with an interest rate hike. It's looking increasingly likely that the Fed is going to raise rates again. And when we look at, say, US 12-month yields, then we're given an indication of that bets are starting to price in another interest rate hike in the not too distant future. That this has been a rangy environment overall for all of this year, and every time it gets up to 70 basis points, it has pulled back, and it is looking like we are going to see it go back up towards that 70 basis points before very long. Now, what can we draw in terms of conclusions from these different evolving questions? The first is that the Fed is very slowly but surely beginning to raise interest rates, but the size of their balance sheet is unlikely to contract. And there is, I think there's a reasonably good reason for that, and it is the velocity of money. The velocity of money has been going down since 1997. And if you think about why, then the correlation between the evolution of the online economy and the disintermediation of the internet, then I think we have a pretty good reason for why we've had this deteriorating velocity of money, because this chart goes all the way back to the 1940s. I think we've only got it going back to 1959, and the velocity of money has never been this low. Something has quite clearly changed. We are in a very different economic environment now than we have been ever. And I think that the internet is a major contributor in that. But if that is indeed the case, then monetary policy is not going to affect it. The exponential pace of technological innovation is, then we can have arguments. Is it enhancing productivity or is it retarding productivity? And then it all comes down to this sort of semantic argument about how do you define productivity overall. If every worker can do more with less, then that would seem to be a reasonably common sense definition of productivity. But unfortunately, that is not how academics measure productivity. What we can conclude, though, is that if this velocity of money is deteriorating, that the number of people required to do the same function, it goes down. The argument for automation increases. That means that per unit worker productivity goes up, but the productivity of the entire population either stays static or deteriorates. And I suspect that that is where the nexus of the difference in the definitions really lies. When we then think about what is it that central banks can do, because they have tried the extraordinary monetary policy. And it's one thing to look at US Treasuries because they are now testing the region of the 200-day moving average. But for example, German yields are just about in positive territory. And JGBs are still in negative territory. So, there, they're trading now at negative nearly 6 basis points. So we're still in an environment where there is an awful lot of money sloshing around, and the real question is that by promoting negative interest rates, which is what Japan and Europe have done, the real question, I suspect, is how long is it going to take them before they are willing to admit that what they are doing is fomenting deflationary pressures, which is literally the exact opposite of what they want to do. The downward pressure that we have seen in the European banking sector over the last, and it isn't just recently, but over the last couple of years already, is a direct response to negative interest rates. If we remember that negative interest rates were introduced, not that long ago, and since then, the Euro Stoxx Banks Index has come all the way right back down to test the lows that it has posted over the last few years. European banks need to be recapitalized. They need to be able to write off the debts that they have. The problem is that the debts that they have are in a multitude of different countries, and if they were to write them off, then it would be the equivalent of giving money to countries, taking it out of creditor nations, and it's just politically untenable. Yet that is exactly what needs to happen. And because we have negative interest rates, and the ECB can argue until they're blue in the face that they are compensating banks for the risks that they're taking by taking with one hand and giving with the other, but the net effect is that it is sharply deflationary. Well, that is a significant headwind. And what we do know for, and I think it is true of any bureaucracy, is that a bureaucracy will persist because it is in the interests of the members of the bureaucracy to ensure that it persists. And therefore, there is no policy initiative that is too extraordinary or too extreme that can't be considered if the integrity of the administration or bureaucracy is threatened. So we have already tried negative interest rates, and we have seen what the results of them are, and it really does also help to exemplify that central bankers have absolutely no comprehension of how the market works. But I don't think that that is news to anybody. Well, then the big question is that if making liquidity available to the financial sector and then going into negative interest rates doesn't make them lend it out, how can they possibly lend it out when the burden of regulation and the file filling or the form filling that they have to go through in order to lend it out is so onerous, and then they have to pay to borrow money, and pay to deposit money, then they are in really a catch-22 situation. So then it's only a question of when do central banks realize that it doesn't work, that banks are liquidity providers, and despite the fact that they have been vilified in the press, and that there is a vindictive emotion of the public towards the sector, the reality is that the banking sector is a major liquidity provider, and unless it can fulfill its function, then it puts undue pressure on the central bank to fulfill that function for it. In Europe, they've already nationalized a significant number of the banks, and again, that neither is that a particularly satisfactory outcome either. So then the big question is, at what point are they going to move towards skipping the banking sector and making money more easily available to the wider public? And I don't think that that is possible unless they enter into a fiscal compact with the governments, because making money available to consumers directly, and that is the eponymous helicopter money, is really only possible if you have the government acting in with the central bank, and because we have such enormous political turmoil on the horizon, you have an election in the US, you have elections in Germany and France next year, you have the referendum in Italy, and then Renzi this week also saying that doesn't matter what happens in the election, he's not going to resign, so walking back from his commitment to resign, which probably gives you a good indication that they really are not confident that it will pass. And on top of all of that, there is going to be a negotiation initiated by the UK to leave the EU. So these are really quite there is a substantial menu of potential volatility items out there. And that's not the kind of thing that will then contribute to a rhythmic trending environment overall, unless we see an additional resumption of very loose monetary policy. Interestingly enough, if we look at the S&P 500 banks index, then we are presented with something a little bit different, because you can see that the index really did bottom in 2008, and then it found a low well above that in 2011, but the European Banks Index was at its low in 2011. It hit another important low in January of this year, and it has been ranging gradually higher. Now, if we look here, that because there is increasing speculation that the Fed will raise interest rates, the banking sector has been recovering in the USA. There is, I think, some indication at least that the US is in a much better, more attractive position overall relative to Europe or Japan. But that doesn't mean that the market is cheap. It really doesn't mean that that the market can surge higher on cheap valuations. However, if the Fed is very slow in raising interest rates, and if they commit that they're not going to be running down the size of of their balance sheet, then there isn't any particular reason why the S&P has to pull back very sharply. On the other hand, if the bond market grows impatient, and the Fed has been quite clear that they don't want the bond market to be too complacent, well, it's looking increasingly likely that the bond market isn't complacent at all, and that they really are looking at where yields are likely to be and what the implications are of for interest rates. So, because, and I think that this is a point that we are going to hear much more about, and it is the role of convexity in bond pricing. I haven't heard a single person talking about convexity in really a very long time, because what we have is that there is, quite clearly there is interest rate risk to bonds, but there hasn't been any concern about that for a decade because we haven't had any interest rate risk. But if the Fed is raising interest rates, then that has to be factored into the pricing of bonds. You have to factor in that there is a sensitivity metric between price and yield, and that how that is calculated is influenced by what the interest rate is likely to be. And the discount method and the discount of how cash flows are calculated is all relative to the discount rate. And the discount rate is bonds. Discount rate is interest rates. So there is a feedback loop. What we have had is for the concurrent inflation of property, bond, and stock markets. So if we start to see some deflationary pressures coming into the big bubble that we've had in the bond markets, then that could act as a headwind, a particularly strong headwind to the equity markets overall. And that's why I look at the Merrill Lynch Total Return Index really almost every day, because it and this has been a particularly consistent period between 2013 and now. it hasn't traded below, and I think this is also important. This part period between 2013 and early 2014 was the first time in the index's history that it had traded for any significant period below the 200-day moving average, because this is one of the most consistent uptrends in history. And when it eventually ends, and I think this is a point that Ray Dalio makes, that there is a long-term debt cycle, a short-term debt cycle. Well, the short-term debt cycle is not flashing warnings, particularly in here right now, because we haven't really seen a lot of interest rate hikes just yet. But the long-term debt cycle is long in the tooth, and when it eventually loses uptrend consistency, when we eventually can look at that chart and say, is it still consistent? Answer, no. And then say, is there any evidence of type 1, type 2, or type 3 trend ending characteristics? And if you look at that trend right now, you couldn't say that it's not consistent. It's still holding above the 200-day moving average. Is there any evidence of type 1, type 2, or type 3? No, there isn't. Well, if there isn't, then we have to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. We can have as many concerns as we want. We can identify that there is massive contradiction in the bond markets, and that contradiction is one of the most acute signs of a mania that there is. Yet, there is an enormous difference between identifying a mania and identifying when the mania has popped, and when the tide of investor sentiment turns against the asset class that has been in the mania. So, this is, I think, an important juncture, because this bond index could yet find support in the region of the moving average, and it could yet rally to a new all-time high. If that is indeed the case, then the 10-year bond yield will encounter resistance in the region of the trend mean, and it will push back down towards its lows. However, there is, and I think that is why this is such an important juncture, because there has been this has been an incredible momentum move. When we look at this total return chart, then it is a multiple of price appreciation and yield, but yield has not contributed to a 10% rise in really just the last 2 years, but price appreciation has, capital appreciation has. Capital appreciation has more than made up for the lack of yield. Now, and that will persist for as long as the momentum trade persists. But the big question, and it really is a big question, is to what extent have the very low interest rate environment contributed to that move? And I think that any common sense answer would have to be that it has contributed a lot. If we're moving out of that in the US, and that they are slowly but surely raising interest rates, then because convexity is much more of an influence, interest rate risk is much more of an influence at low rates than it is at high rates. So we're at extraordinarily low rates, and therefore the risk and convexity risk is much higher than it has been in fact, historically, because we are at historically low rates, and yet nobody is talking about it. I haven't heard the word convexity come up in a conversation about bonds in a very long time. So I think that that is something that is being underappreciated by the markets. But the question is whether it is going to become a short-term problem or a medium-term problem. And I think a great deal will depend on whether the Fed does indeed raise interest rates. What there is the potential, and I think there are two potential outcomes. If this trend remains consistent, then we are not going to have a succession of interest rate hikes. The market will conclude that the liquidity-fueled environment is still intact, and that will act as an additional drive to support the stock market to move higher. What we also see is that there is increasing M&A activity, that Snapchat is now going for an IPO, and it's going to IPO in the region of $25 billion. So, really not a small company. Twitter is being taken over. Then we're getting these big attempted mergers like Bayer and Monsanto, whether that goes through or not, or Microsoft paying up to buy LinkedIn. So, what we are definitely seeing is that companies are using extraordinarily low interest rates to buy growth rather than try to develop it themselves. Now, that is also a function of low interest rates, that it is cheaper for those types of companies to just go out and buy companies than it is to develop and take the risk of developing themselves. Now, that's also that if we're getting big companies starting to IPO, then you really do have to ask yourself, when is the best time to sell your company? And generally speaking, the best time to IPO is when you can get more for it than you think it's worth. And I think it is quite interesting that the IPO index has been rallying and rallying impressively all year. It had certainly pulled back at the end of last year, but it has been rallying and rallying impressively all year. And I think part of the reason for that is because of Alibaba. I think Baba is probably still in that index, and it has staged an impressive rally. Now, I think it is interesting that obviously China has been closed for the Golden Week holiday this week, and Golden Week is a very big week for the consumer sector in China because there are two Golden Weeks in the year. One is in for the Mid-Autumn Festival, and the other is for New Year. But everybody has to go home to see their family for New Year, so they can go on holiday in October. Then, companies like Ctrip, that is basically the Chinese equivalent of Expedia, have been trending higher. Companies like Prada have been trending down for really quite a long time, and at least have some evidence of base formation development, and the technology, or the excuse me, the luxury goods sector overall has been fairly resilient. The gambling sector has been on a recovery trajectory. So, if we look at what it is that Chinese people are buying, or the marketplaces that they're using to buy things, then they seem to be turning upwards. So the I think the Shenzhen B market is I think the best way of looking at the new consumer sector in mainland China, rather than looking specifically at Hong Kong. But Hong Kong has been doing rather well. But that has been closed all week. But we can see from this index that it is not near its lows, that the Shenzhen B shares are significantly above their lows, and that in fact the index has been trading above 1,000, which is historically high relative to where it traded from 2007 onwards, for just about all of the last year. And really, a sustained move below that big psychological level would be required to really question the potential for the market to continue higher. Whereas the H shares index has staged a rally and has broken a medium-term progression of lower rally highs, but it is trading in that sort of psychological level around the 10,000, and does need to start trading above it to really confirm that the demand side of the equation is now back in dominance. When we look at the dollar, and I think that what's happening with the dollar overall is giving us a very good indication of where we are in the cycle, because it really did trend lower from the early 2000s until 2007, 2008, and then did nothing at all for much of the last 6 years. But it did break out in 2014, and that has broken this perception that the dollar really only goes down. That has really upset the apple cart in terms of, what is easy to buy, what is easy to make money from. Because all the way from the early 2000s, all you had to do was short the dollar, or take your money out of dollars, invest it into something that was not in the dollar, most particularly in emerging markets or commodity producers. Then you got capital appreciation, currency market appreciation, and you even picked up a yield. And that was a really nice recipe for making money, and it is largely over. That sort of buy and forget about it attitude towards commodity producers and emerging markets has been really upset. So now the dollar has been in this range, and the way we define ranges is as explosions waiting to happen. We know that there is this wedgy characteristic overall over the last year, that when the breakout comes, it's going to be a big one. Now, when we look at, for example, the ASEAN region, and I'm just using an ETF to kind of think about that. It trended lower from 2013 to 2015, which was concurrent with the rally in the dollar, and with the dollar going largely sideways this year, it has been able to stage an advance. Now the Asia Dollar Index, which really did trend lower all the way from 2011 to really the beginning of this year, has at least steadied. And that is heavily influenced by what happens in the renminbi. But when we look at, for example, the rupiah, then the Indonesian rupiah hit an important low above 14,000 last year, and that is emblematic of what happened with a number of other currencies. We can see a very similar pattern for the Thai baht, and that by and large these currencies have been getting stronger against the dollar. That has helped to stoke additional investor interest in some of these markets, and I think that it is worth maybe taking the time and looking at some of the really long-term charts, because if you look at those really long-term charts, then a number of these Asian markets are trading, in the region of peaks that haven't been seen in really a very long time. And the real question for them is, whether they can, whether their currencies can help to justify a bullish environment overall. And what happens with the dollar is likely to have a significant knock-on effect for a number of these Asian markets and commodity-producing markets overall. But when, for example, we look at Korea or Taiwan or Thailand or Indonesia, they are trading in the region of their peaks, but they're in the region of historic peaks. The Taiwanese market, for example, hit an accelerated peak with Japan in the late 1980s and has never got back to that peak, but it is really not that far away from the upper side of what has been a decades-long range. Really not that much has to go right for some of these indices to start breaking out. But one of the big constituents will be that the dollar cannot rally too much against these respective currencies. And I think we have to question whether that is likely, because the one thing that has been holding back the Asia dollar index is the renminbi. I think the Chinese need a weaker currency. If they were to allow it to float, I think it would be back around 9 rather than 4. They are going through a massive rationalization of their coal and steel and cement sectors. And if we looked at the consumer shares as an indication of what is the health of the Chinese consumer, then maybe we should look at the steel shares to see whether they represent a potential indication that there is, in fact, some rationalization of the steel sector in China, which would allow them to compete a bit better. And I think it is interesting that, like, say, one of the largest ones, ArcelorMittal, has held a progression of higher reaction lows just about all year. And, you know, if we look at, for example, U.S. Steel, you know, then, you know, it has been subject to some, you know, pretty incredible volatility, but it has held a progression of higher reaction lows, or Allegheny Technologies, which would be Speciality Steel, has also found support in the region of its trend mean. Well, if that is indeed the case, then, you know, maybe we do have evidence that the Chinese are moving through this rationalization. They are following through on delivering it, but they probably need a continuing weakness in the currency in order to be able to fund it and to be able to preserve their own export capacity, because you simply can't cut back on infrastructure development without something to pick up the pace, or pick up what you're losing when you're rationalizing all of those industries. Now, if then we really are at an important juncture, because it is looking like China might indeed be able to pull through, and that has been a massive engine for economic growth. It's not nearly the same engine for economic growth that it has been, but it is not a contractionary factor overall on the wider economy. What is perhaps much more important is, what do Europe and Japan do in terms of their monetary policy? And against that background, nothing is going to stop the billions of young people growing up and entering the workforce, and improving governance is a major factor in that. India continues to represent the country with by far the most attractive of demographics of any country. What they really do need is improving governance to help to continue to drive that market higher. It is overbought in the short term. It is likely to consolidate, but generally speaking, India and the Indian rupee is also the lightning rod for institutional international investors. They'll be looking at the rupee because they don't want to see it depreciating, and I suspect that it will not depreciate for the simple reason that yields are very attractive in India. That you can pick up 6.75% on Indian bonds, and that's in an environment where the currency has been reasonably steady. That you'd have to have a significant move in the currency to make that a losing trade, and this trend is clearly accelerating, because you just simply can't get that kind of yield elsewhere. That represents significant funding appreciation for the Indian government. And it really would allow them to do a lot more with the money that they're borrowing. So I think that it is a generally rosy tone overall, that when we look at these countries where you do have improving governance, that they are getting better terms in terms of their funding. And that is helping them to drive their respective economies. The pace of technological innovation is an enormous challenge. There is absolutely no question of that, but it also represents an enormous opportunity, especially for emerging markets, because they get to skip whole steps in terms of their long-term economic development. By that, not only do we have technology that is growing exponentially, but it is becoming instantly globally fungible, and that is particularly the case in software. It is increasingly software that is driving efficiencies in the global economy. Now, that combined with the generally positive tone overall would suggest that significant pullbacks are likely to be buying opportunities in the emerging markets for the foreseeable future, as long as governance is improving. The outlook for the dollar and the outlook for treasuries is going to have an effect. That if we do see, and I'm not necessarily predicting that this is exactly the moment that we're going to see a big move in the dollar or a big move in yields, but we most definitely have to be alert to the possibility that it could have a disrupting effect overall. I honestly think that I don't think there's been a more important time over the last 3 or 4 years to pay attention to the consistency of the charts overall, because Wall Street absolutely needs to hold this breakout. If it fails, then we're going to move into a much more volatile environment overall, and obviously that will also create value. It will allow some of the overvaluations to be unwound, but it is likely to be much more difficult overall. And I think with that, I'm going to leave you for today. I'm heading off to San Diego this afternoon to attend the XMed conference, which is organized by Google's Singularity University. And I think there's going to be a lot of very interesting people talking there on the technology of the future. And I look forward to being able to share all of that with you next week. I will be coming back on Monday, so to let you know that I may be recording the audio a bit later, and I think that will be subject to traffic. You will probably get the audio maybe a bit later on Monday, but I will certainly try my best to get it done as quickly or as close to the Wall Street close as possible. And and I really do think that technological innovation is a phenomenal enabler for economic growth and for enhancing quality of life overall. But it also requires that we adapt and continue to be receptive to adaption, because to try and negate the march of technology is likely to not represent a particularly smart thing to do. And that is particularly the case for the energy sector, that OPEC is really scrambling to try and preserve its dominant position in the oil markets. But I think the writing is on the wall for oil, but it is likely to remain, by far the most important of all commodities for at least another decade, and that and also subject to, I think, quite incredible volatility as this war between supply and demand plays out. But if we start to look beyond that, then the relative importance of oil in the economy is likely to deteriorate, and most particularly because of technology. And I think with that, I'm going to leave you for the weekend, and I wish all the best to all of you.